Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. We'll hear from Khaled Hurub, one of the world's leading experts in Hamas, who will analyze the politics and appeal of that much demonized organization. And from Pablo Abufom, who will review the results of the recent elections in Chile, which were a major victory for the left in one of the original homelands of neoliberalism. In the West, Hamas is one of the most demonized organizations around, but it has proven durably popular among Palestinians. Why? Hamas, founded in 1987, emerged out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had spread beyond its Egyptian origins, setting up in Palestine in the 1940s. Soon after its founding, Hamas began a series of suicide bombing attacks and civilian targets in Israel that continued through 2008. Hamas is now best known for its rocket attacks launched from Gaza into Israel. Aside from those attacks, though, Westerners know next to nothing about Hamas, which is quite a complex organization. In 2006, it won an election, much to the surprise of the U.S. and Israel, to take control of the government of Gaza, a government with severely limited powers, of course, thanks to the Israeli occupation, but nonetheless a task it has managed with some success. The Palestinian Authority, dominated by the old PLO, controls the West Bank, but is widely seen among Palestinians as corrupt and ineffective. But it's the organization Western powers want to deal with because it's pliable. Hamas, by contrast, is portrayed as nothing but a terrorist organization, but it's worth hearing a fuller story. Here's Khaled Hurub, a professor at the Qatar campus of Northwestern University, with more. He's the author of two books on Hamas, most recently Hamas, A Beginner's Guide. Khaled Hurub.
What is the role of Hamas in the governance of the Gaza Strip?
Hamas, since 2007, has been, the sole governor of Gaza Strip. They won the elections in 2006. In the West Bank and the Gaza Strip together. And then a year after that, there was some sort of threat and conflict between them and Fatah. And that ended with them controlling the Gaza Strip and Fatah and the PLO controlling the West Bank. So you can say Hamas is in full control of the Gaza Strip since then.
And the West Bank, what's the relation with PLO and the West Bank?
In the West Bank, we have the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and he himself is the chairman of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. So you have, within the Palestinian politics, you have some sort of a split politically and geography. In terms of politics, you have the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and the PLO that are controlling the West Bank, and then you have Hamas controlling the Gaza Strip.
Do they see eye to eye on relations with Israel, or do they have differences?
They do have differences, and the main difference comes from the overarching strategy, I would say. For the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, they have been engaged in, let's say, the so-called peace process since 1993. So you have one track which is based on peace talks with Israel. The PLO renounced any armed struggle since 1988, saying our strategy now is to try to attain our Palestinian rights through peace talks and negotiations. This is something that Hamas disagreed with. And instead, they said, Israel won't listen to this, and we will adhere to the military option. The military option that the PLO itself used to practice for many, many years. Politically speaking, you have a split in terms of the strategy. Hamas believes in resistance and armed struggle. The Palestinian Authority and the PLO, they believe in peace talks and the peace process.
You have to say that the peace process has not really yielded much in the way of results, so Hamas has a point here, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. So this is why Hamas has been somehow amassing popular support and even legitimacy since 1993, in fact, because this so-called peace process, it has been, as everybody knows, it has been a process without peace. So without resulting in any tangible, any concrete benefits for the Palestinians. In fact, many Palestinians have been witnessing the deterioration of their rights and position and standing in parallel with the so-called peace process. And this, in many ways, has been capitalized upon by Hamas. So the more decline in the peace process, And with it, the decline of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority, this happens in tandem with the increase of legitimacy, support, and the ground that Hamas has been gaining, saying we have been through this for 28 years without any benefits. And enough is enough. In those years, we have been seeing Israel expansions in terms of settlements, in terms of occupying more land, in terms of humiliation. In every single aspect, we have been at the losing end. So enough is enough. So this is why, in fact, this is the backdrop of why Hamas is gaining more support within the Palestinians, despite the huge losses nowadays in Gaza Strip. Still, though, we have seen in the streets, in the West Bank, in Gaza, elsewhere, people expressing their support to Hamas and thinking that this is the national defender of our cause. The Palestinian Authority and the PLO have lost really dearly throughout the final round of conflict.
All right, let's step back. Hamas was founded, what, in 1987,
88? Yeah, 1987, yeah.
What are its origins?
Hamas, in a nutshell, is a Palestinian organization. In the Western media, people think of Hamas or portray Hamas as an alien kind of organization or body landed maybe from a different planet in Palestine. In fact, no. This is a kind of an emerging movement from within the Palestinian people and from the Palestinian society. The origin of Hamas goes back to 1940s, even before the creation of the State of Israel, and that was during the British Mandate. At that time, you have the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood branching out to neighboring countries, the neighboring countries of Egypt, and having different branches in Syria and Jordan, Iraq, and Palestine. So you have had this organization as a religious organization, interested in social work, in religious teaching at the very grassroots level. And then after the creation of the State of Israel, this organization that was somehow kind of weak and not really politically influential within the Palestinian politics, because you had other Palestinian parties, they took the lead when it comes to the national cause. So this organization, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, which is the mother organization of Hamas, they kept low profile, more or less. They were kind of somehow weaker than others. They focused on, again, religious and social work during the 50s, 60s, into the 70s and 80s. By that time, we have had across the region this revival of Islamist phenomenon and the trend. So since then, 1980s, after the Iran revolution, we have this trend, again, sweeping across the Middle East. In every single country, you have now an Islamist movement. In Palestine, the reflection of this regional phenomena was the increase of the power of the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. Internally in Palestine, in 1987, we have the first Intifada, which is popular uprising against Israel. And at that critical time, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood decided to transform themselves from only religious organization that was only obsessed maybe and concentrated on social and religious work to focusing on the confrontation with Israel. So that was the decisive turning moment in 1987. You have the old organization now repackaging themselves, reframing themselves and the strategy, gearing toward the confrontation with Israel. And then they renamed themselves as Hamas. This confrontational strategy that was adopted in 1987 is the crucial and decisive moment for this Islamist group in Palestine. And it gave this group legitimacy. Because until that moment, in fact, many Palestinians would see the inactive Palestinian Islamists in the confrontation against Israel in a suspicious eye. Why on earth every single national Marxist leftist Palestinian group is engaged in the confrontation against Israel, but you, the Islamist movement, are not? This kind of lack of engagement didn't change as from 1987. And since they decided on this new strategy, they started to increase their support, because being on the resistance side is what gets you more political and popular capital in Palestine because of the Israeli occupation. Of course, this is the main context.
Hamas has several branches of operation. There's a political, there's a military, there's a religious, there's also a social welfare operation. Talk about how these branches work together and who is the ultimate leadership within the organization.
Hamas functions in different areas, politically, socially, religiously, providing education, social services, so on and so forth. And even in the sport and other kind of maybe entertainment aspects. And then you have the military wing as well. People in the West and elsewhere, they are focusing on the military side of it, which is very reductionist for me. And it doesn't explain the popularity and the strength of the movement upon which it won the elections of 2006. Because if it was only reduced or only kind of functioning within the military kind of area, I think they wouldn't be able to succeed in terms of winning those elections. This said, you have a hierarchy or a kind of a leadership that goes from bottom up. They have internal elections, and then they have regional different kind of rankings and sub-regional leaderships, and this produces the so-called consultation council. This is Majlis Ashura, the consultation meaning, like, you know, this is the internal parliament of Hamas. That would produce the political bureau of the leadership. And then on the top of this political body, you have the leader of Hamas. Nowadays, he is Ismail Haniyeh. So this political kind of leadership organizes and oversees the different activities of the entire movement, be them political, social, religious, and so on and so forth. And then you have the military wing as well, which is, at the end of the day, comes under the political leadership. And this is something which is, for me, something really deserves observation. That is, still the military wing in Hamas functions until the full leadership of the political leadership, which is amazing in different, if you like, in different situations in the Middle East and elsewhere. You have the military kind of part or the military wing of these movements becoming stronger, and even they would impose their will on the political wing. And the political wing or leadership becomes marginalized. Until this very moment, we can say the case within Hamas is the civilian-military relationship is a clear-cut favoring the ultimate control of the political leadership.
And the social welfare operations are extremely important, both for the people of Gaza in particular, but also for establishing its popularity, right? It's politically important as well as humanely important.
Social welfare provides great capital in terms of the support that comes from the people themselves. And this has been proven for decades. This is nothing new. This goes even since 1950s, 1960s, with the older organization, the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. So, and it pays off. That kind of long, sustained, incremental at one stage or another was building up. And then it ended up with this very strong social infrastructure for Hamas. So when they decided to become like a military movement that they are nowadays, or to run for elections, they are backed by that kind of strong social infrastructure. And even with the control of Israel in Gaza Strip, that was before, you know, before the Israeli withdrawal in 2005, Hamas's work could be seen as a mini state, a state within a state. With the Palestinian Authority coming in, even 1994, still though you have the different organizations and charities of Hamas functioning in the Palestinian refugee camps, towns, and cities, and providing face-to-face kind of social services and charities and help. So many people think of Hamas's social work as done out of charity before even getting into the business of politics and military, with a clean hand, with the least corruption. So all these different kind of characteristics that we can see in Hamas's work over a very, very long period of time, they are now paying off. They are yielding the support that we are seeing now, especially against the failure that the Palestinian people are seeing on the side of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO. You don't have any achievements on this side in the West Bank under the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. And on the other hand, you see people see different track record despite the blockade. And this is a very important point that we need to focus on. That is, the Gaza Strip since 2005 2006 has been placed under kind of air, sea, and land blockade from Israel. 2 million Palestinians under this kind of inhumane blockade, and yet you still have successes. So people say, well, if in the West Bank you don't have the same blockade, things are open, the Palestinian Authority can should deliver much better than what they are doing nowadays, and yet they failed. And then in parallel, in contrast, you have Hamas people in Gaza Strip. They have been facing all sorts of pressures under this siege. And yet, relatively speaking, it's not kind of a rosy picture, of course. Still, people are suffering. But compared to the other side of the fence in the West Bank, people would say, well, would give more credit to Hamas. And then they managed to manufacture these local rockets and this and that. That would deter, influence Israel, or they would kind of do some great impact. Not at the same impact, of course, of the Israeli military, but they would give the Palestinian people some pride and some sense of that we can say, no, we can retaliate.
I'm speaking with the Middle Eastern studies scholar Khaled Haroub. In the 1988 founding document, the Charter has some pretty extravagant language. Pretty anti-Jewish language, but also, you know, ambitions to basically kick Israel out of existence. They've retreated from that rhetoric somewhat now. So what is the ultimate goal? What's their vision of what the Middle East or Palestine should look like?
Yeah, well, they start from kind of this anti-colonial, maybe overarching perspective, seeing Israel as a colonial state, entirely from the Mediterranean Sea to River Jordan. So they don't accept, you know, even the existence of Israel. That was at the very beginning. Now they started in, over time to toning down this kind of language and becoming more, let's say, pragmatic in their discourse. This happened, again, in different maybe main milestones throughout the past 2-3 decades. The very final one, the official one now, you could say, well, I name it, as the new charter of Hamas, the document that was issued in 2017. And in this document, you have more kind of nationalistic instead of religious organization. So the overtone, the language, the references became more Palestinized as opposed to more kind of religious language that was used previously. Politically speaking, they started to talk about a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So inching towards the same, not the same, but closer to what the PLO believes in nowadays and the Palestinian Authority, the so-called two-state solution. They don't say the two-state solution. What they are saying is, we accept a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and then they leave things somehow kind of vague and not necessarily very clear. And this is deliberate. They wouldn't say we are having the same proposition, the same kind of belief, the same strategy as the PLO. Otherwise, people would say, well, the PLO has failed. So what's new and the new strategy? And they, all the time, they try to be kind of wary of this, to leave a distance between the failed project of the PLO and themselves.
These rocket attacks, what is the thinking behind them? To a lot in the outside world, they seem pointless, targeted directly at civilians, and therefore a war crime. You hear that kind of language. And they're largely ineffective. Between, you know, they're just weak explosives, they're poorly guided missiles, but also the Israeli Iron Dome defense shoots down most of them. So what is the point of these, what, they launched 1,000 so far in this recent episode of violence. So what are they hoping to accomplish with these attacks?
Yes, first of all, in terms of material damage, is very minimal. However, in my view, the political damage of these rockets on the adversary parties of Hamas is, in my view, great. They are kind of pushing back Israeli aggression in their view, and they are telling the Palestinian people that we are the only party, the only Palestinian party that can say no to Israel and their kind of brutal attacks against Gaza. Not only this, specifically in this round of rocket launching, they are saying we are not using them to defend Gaza, but we are using these rockets for Jerusalem, because the people in Jerusalem, the Palestinians in Jerusalem, who have been at the receiving end of Israeli police brutality, everybody was seeing this in cameras and this and that, and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and they had nobody to help them. Not the Palestinian Authority, not any regional country, not any Arab country, not even the international community, and they called upon Hamas. Hamas's use of these sockets for Jerusalem, they are in fact claiming national leadership, saying, in practice, we are the party that interferes when it comes to the crucial and most sensitive Palestinian issues, including Jerusalem. It's us who speaks in the name of the Palestinians. We are the line of defense of Palestinian rights. And this is a very effective, in fact, message within the Palestinian people, be them in, not only in the Gaza Strip, but also in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, and even inside the Green Line, Israel proper. So this is kind of very effective. They will not damage or liberate Palestine in the sockets, but they are gaining more and more legitimacy and leadership within the Palestinian people and within the region as well. Now they think, and I have been reading some kind of Hamas's leaders on the statements, saying even the whole world now in Europe, the European Union, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, has said we need to talk to Hamas, even if this could be indirectly. Other people in across Europe and elsewhere. In fact, you know, the United States, they speak to Hamas maybe indirectly through Qatar and through Egypt. So they are kind of, I guess, imposing themselves as an indispensable party, in not only in Palestine, but also in the Middle East. If you want to talk to the Palestinians, if you want to talk to Palestine, you need to talk to Hamas. So this is, I think, the magnitude of these rockets and Hamas's military at large.
Events of the last few weeks, do you think these have strengthened or weakened Hamas or left it pretty much the same as it was before?
Oh, this is very, very hard to judge, in fact, because from the media reporting, the Israeli media reporting, we could say, yes, they have been hit, maybe hit hard, but the main core of their military infrastructure is still there intact. A Hamas leader in Gaza delivered a speech, and it was kind of broadcast live on the media here and there. And he said, we are sending our kind of fighters now to march into the tunnels, basically pointing at what has been said in, by Israeli military, that we have destroyed these tunnels. So in a defiant tone, as if he is saying, we are still there, even our tunnels are hardly touched. And the fact that until the very last minute before the ceasefire, they were able to launch some of these rockets tells us their capabilities are still strong. And they wanted to make this bold statement that we haven't been weakened. We are as strong as we were when we started this war. And again, it's a political message. It's not only kind of a military message, but I think for me, it's a military, a political message to say, we are here, and we are the address.
And what are the prospects for Hamas displacing the Palestinian Authority and Abbas, who is 85 and therefore pretty easily displaced at some point, in the West Bank?
If it wasn't for the backing that comes from Israel, the United States, and some kind of regional countries to Abbas and his Palestinian Authority, I can't see them kind of withstand this advancement that is happening by Hamas. Abbas himself, at the very last moment, he canceled the Palestinian elections that were scheduled to take place in the 22nd, in fact, today, fearing that Hamas would win. He feared Hamas's victory even before this very last round of conflict, which has even added more legitimacy and the clout for Hamas's influence. So when it comes to elections, I think Hamas will win. When it comes to military performance and speaking or defending the Palestinians, in the eyes of the Palestinians, Hamas is winning. So in different kind of areas, Hamas is the only area that Hamas is not really there is kind of the international recognition, maybe, and the support from regional Jordan and the Gulf. So ironically speaking, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian president is having more external legitimacy and external support to continue in his position more than any internal support. He is really deeply challenged internally, and he can do it. He is now afraid of doing any Palestinian election, and I think it's now off the table. And rumors have been before this round of conflict that American and some Arab voices and advice was telling Abbas to postpone these elections because, again, the polls and surveys were telling that he is losing and his party, Fatah, was losing.
It's just remarkable that this very small, poorly financed organization can hold off and, in some senses, politically weaken this enormously powerful army with all its fancy weapons. On the surface, you'd think the imbalance of power would be so much in Israel's favor. And obviously, Israel can do a lot of damage, both militarily and socially through the occupation. But it's just a remarkable act of resistance. What do you attribute this to?
What Hamas has been doing and capitalizing on is the notion of resistance. They know very well that this is kind of deeply rooted in the Palestinian psyche. And again, because of the failure of any other strategy, including the so-called peace process. So still people feel the need to resist. They look at Israel as this is the occupying military brutal power with this kind of military might that nobody could even face up to in the region. And now you have this party again in this located under siege Gaza Strip, very small territory, is doing almost the impossible. And it's really drawing a huge admiration within the Palestinians. That is how on earth they manage to have this kind of sustained line of resistance and rockets and this and that, and then to inflict, yes, it's kind of maybe not great, but certain damage on Israel to the point where they imposed curfew on Israeli cities. So you have this sense of dignity and self-respect. And again, thinking of Hamas as the line of defense and the protector of the Palestinians is now widespread across the Palestinians. It's kind of, again, maybe ironic that despite the damage and the death toll in Gaza Strip, people feel that finally somebody could stand in the face of Israel against the daily humiliation that was imposed on the Palestinians. And they have been through this long, many, many years of slow death, slow and silent death. And when they want to scream out loud, then Israel would hit them back that you are not allowed. This now is scream, which is Hamas, is gathering a great momentum within the Palestinian society, saying, yes, we don't want to stay in this track of silent and slow death. We want the whole world to know that we are suffering. We are 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip that was described by UN organizations as unsuitable for living conditions. And so the Palestinians, they have mixed feelings, of course, pain, loss, destruction, but you still have pride, dignity, and self-respect. So it's kind of mixed picture. But on the balance sheet, I think Hamas emerged winning greatly out of this.
That was Khaled Haroub, a professor at the Qatar campus of Northwestern University. His book, Hamas, A Beginner's Guide, was published in 2006 by Pluto. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Swiss running down your back. It's suffix in the sun, cold as suffix in the night. Your kiss so sweet, your sweat so sour. Sometimes I'm thinking that I love you, but I know it's only lust. A change has done you good, I always knew it would. You know the change will do you good. You know the change will do you good. Some of Damaged Goods by the Idols, part of an imminently forthcoming compilation of Gang of Four covers called The Problem of Leisure. They've been tease-releasing selected tracks over the last few weeks. The full album will be out on June 4th. And now on to my second guest, Pablo Abufom.
Obafemi is a political analyst and translator based in Santiago, Chile. A couple of weeks ago, Chile held elections for local and regional offices and for the body that is going to rewrite the dreadful old constitution left over from the era of Augusto Pinochet, a document that embodied neoliberalism in its most authoritarian form. Those elections yielded some good results, a major victory for forces of the left. Some historical background. In 1970, Chileans elected the socialist Salvador Allende as president. His government nationalized some businesses, notably copper mining, a major industry and a major source of export revenue, as well as banking, and moved to expand social benefits and employment. These moves greatly annoyed the Chilean elite and the U.S., both of which began plotting against him. He was overthrown by a military coup on September 11, 1973, and replaced by a military junta led by General Augusto Pinochet, who eventually took full control. Pinochet's regime cracked down on the left, killing at least 3,000, including several hundred who were just dropped out of helicopters, and imprisoning and frequently torturing 10 times that many. On the advice of University of Chicago-trained free-market economists, Pinochet established a purely neoliberal regime. Social spending was cut and public industries were privatized, an agenda that would travel around the world in ensuing decades. That early start is one reason why Chile is sometimes known as the homeland of neoliberalism. Pinochet stayed in office until 1990, but the constitutional framework he established has lingered to the present. Over the last decade, there have been repeated protests against the hangover from the Pinochet era, protests that intensified starting in 2019, initially sparked by a rise in public transport fares, but fueled by broad and long-standing discontents. The right-wing government of Sebastián Piñera, a billionaire economist and businessman, met the protests with a severe crackdown, but they persisted, and the government finally assented to a referendum on writing a new constitution. That measure passed overwhelmingly last October, and the delegates to the body that will rewrite the document were elected in mid-May. Here's Pablo Obafemi with more. Chile had some elections a couple of weeks ago, big results, although a small turnout. Could you just give the summary of what was at stake and what were the results?
It was sort of a mega election. We were electing local officials for city council and also regional government. But most importantly, we were electing the representatives for the Constitutional Convention. So it's the assembly that is going to draft the new constitution. And so we were electing a lot of people. Maybe that's one of the reasons of the low turnout, some analysts say. And that basically, it's pretty important because the Constitutional Convention was the result of massive protest. Some have called it a popular revolt in October 2019. And after a month of protests and mass mobilizations in the streets everywhere, all around the country, the government and the political establishment decided to reach an agreement to offer the Chilean people the opportunity to change the constitution.
That constitution was from the Pinochet era, right?
Exactly, yeah. It was drafted in the late 70s. And it was approved in a fraudulent referendum in 1980. So the 1980 constitution has become sort of like the target for leftist and progressive critique, political critique, since those days, since the 80s.
What were some of the noxious features of that constitution?
Well, in a way, it was a crystallization of neoliberal policies that were implemented in the 70s after Pinochet came to power. For instance, the fact that the state has no essential right to be involved in the economy. So it has no right to have, I would say, productive companies. It has only a role in subsidizing private corporations, for instance. That's one of the biggest and most important features in terms of the economic policy that a country could have. But then it's strongly based on a national security doctrine that was promoted by the U.S. everywhere, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So it's basically, some call it a restricted democracy, right? So political representation was constrained to a two-party system for a long time in Chile. And what we're seeing right now, at least since October 9, 2019, very explicitly, is the collapse of that two-party system and a very deep crisis in political representation in Chile. And that's why the election results are so important, because we're seeing the emergence of new sectors of the people, both from the right and the left, I have to say, that are claiming to to have their own political representation, not following the same two mainstream parties that have governed the country for the past 30 years.
So tell us about some of the forces that were victorious.
The first thing is that our government right now is led by a right-wing coalition. The president, it's a businessman. He owns big companies in Chile, so that's the sort of coalition that's ruling the country. It's a conservative Catholic coalition also. And they definitely lost the election. They were expecting to at least get a third of the constitutional convention, which would allow them to block progressive change, and they didn't, because the constitutional convention is supposed to approve any new norm, any new article of the constitution by two-thirds. So they were expecting to have that, at least that third, and they didn't get that. So that's a very important thing. And then the center-left that has been governing the country together with the right wing in the past 30 years, they were the big losers of the election. And then you have the Communist Party and the Frente Amplio, which is, you would translate it as broad front, is the left progressive coalition it was born in 2014 out of the student mobilizations that happened in 2011. Those two parties, they had a coalition, and you would say they are the winners in this electoral contest, not just because they have pretty decent representation in the Constitutional Convention, but they also got elected to office in city council and city governments and regional governments. And that's important, for instance, in the capital city of Santiago, in the main municipality of Santiago, which has always been a conservative municipality. Now we have a communist female mayor. And that's huge. I live in Santiago, and it's going to definitely be a huge change. But then also something that's very important is the slates for the election, for the constitutional convention, allowed independent candidates to run by themselves, but also to build a collective slate. So we had social movements that were running to participate in the constitutional convention. For instance, the environmentalists from the feminist movement and other community organizers. And those independent slates, they also won a very important position. You would say at least a third, but maybe even more than that in the constitutional convention. And that's what I was referring before, that there's a crisis in the political representation in Chile, and you've seen this emergence of new sectors claiming for political representation. And this seems to be what happens for the Constitutional Convention.
And what about indigenous people in Chile? How large a population is it, and how well did they do in the election?
The indigenous peoples in Chile, there are several that have been here since before the Spanish came. And the most well-known one is the Mapuche people living in the south, but they are there is a huge diaspora everywhere in the country, and the same with other groups. Officially, it's a small population, but then this country was built on those populations, so it's probably more widespread than what people recognize when they are asked in the census. This election was a very interesting new feature of this election. We had, on the one hand, gender parity system, so the slates and the election, the results had to be 50-50 in terms of female and male. And then we had reserved seats for the indigenous peoples. And there were 17 seats that were reserved for indigenous people. So people who claimed to have an indigenous ancestry, they would go and elect those representatives. So that's interesting. Also, because the indigenous peoples in Chile, even though they live in areas and regions that are more to the right, In political terms, the representatives that were elected are definitely more open to, of course, to a criticism of colonial state in Chile, of capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So that's also very interesting.
Some of what we used to call the new social movements, feminist LGBT groups, for example, ecologists, students, did quite well, but labor did not. What happened with labor?
I think it's an open question. People have been trying to analyze that. I think that this political crisis in Chile, this crisis of representation, has been not just about political parties, but also about the labor movement. It's been also about what workers perceive as bureaucrats in the big labor unions. That's one thing. But then it also happens that the working class in Chile has changed a lot since the old guard of the 60s and 70s, big labor unions and stuff like that. And you see now a highly precarious workforce that is not organized in unions in the same way as before, not to mention the restrictive labor policies of the state in Chile. But so the working class has changed in a way that it has found political representation or ways to organize itself, not mostly through unions, but through social movements and political collectives and political new political parties. So I think that's one of the reasons for that performance for unions and labor unions in the election.
The Communist Party did fairly well. That seems like kind of out of place in amidst all these new social movements. How do they fit in? What are they like? What's their complexion politically?
It's a very classic Communist Party in the sense that it kept its Stalinist policies, but it definitely changed the way it was proposing them. I mean, they are all about developmentalist perspective for the economy and industrialization and nationalization of natural resources, for instance, but it's a very democratic, in a very democratic perspective. The Communist Party was part of the government of the coalition. It was called the Nueva Mayoría, but it was basically the Communist Party plus the parties that had governed the country since after the dictatorship. So they have progressively been integrating into the political system in Chile as a way that it's their strategy to change the state from within into a more social democratic state. And in that way, they are more close to the social democratic left parties in Europe than to the old communist parties of the 30s and 40s.
Okay, what is the path now forward? What's the process of writing this new constitution? How long is it going to take? Who exactly is going to do it? How do they do it?
It's supposed to take 9 months. It can be extended to 12 months, so in a year. The convention is going to start in a month, sort of like in a month and a half. So by July, we should have the convention already set up and beginning its work. Actually, the first battle within the convention is going to be to regulate, to build the regulations, the guidelines for the process itself. So how decisions are going to be made. We'll see if this is what some people in the now anti-neoliberal majority in the convention to claim that the convention is sovereign, that it doesn't have to obey the constitutional reform that brought it into existence, which happened last year, that it can declare itself sovereign and actually, for instance, get rid of the two-thirds majority to make decisions. So we'll see that it's going to be a political debate, a political battle all for a long time. And we'll probably see, as I was saying, an anti-neoliberal majority pushing a radically progressive agenda, at least publicly. I don't know if we'll get to see a constitution that enshrines social rights and maybe even question some of the more extreme features of private property in Chile, for instance, the property on water, which has our country in a deep ecological crisis in some areas with people that have no access to running water. We'll see if that happens. But at least we'll definitely see a very interesting moment of political debate, political education for huge sectors of society that have been deprived of political participation for decades.
I'm speaking with the Chilean political analyst Pablo Abufum. What's happening in the rest of Latin America now? How does this fit into regional developments? You know, we've seen the pink tide came and went. Some talk maybe it's coming back, but Brazil certainly not seeing the pink tide right now that we would have liked to see. Is Chile an outlier, or does this say something about regional politics that's larger than just the country?
I think it depends on how you look at it. If you just see the political tendency in of the governments, It's a mess. The kind of stability, you would say, of the neoliberal 90s and the pink tide in the 2000s, now it's all over the place. You have, of course, you have Bolsonaro, and then you have the return of Evo Morales through Arce in Bolivia, and AMLO in Mexico. So if you just look at the political tendency of the government, it's difficult to see the situation. But if you look at the maybe longer tendencies, you see that the idea that there's a crisis of the political centers that happens everywhere. Bolsonaro is a case for that. And then in Chile, you see the center that's collapsing, and the same in Bolivia, and the same in Argentina, etc. So that's at least one thing. And then I think the pandemic also had a deep impact in that political crisis. Every country has not been able to, confront the pandemic in a way that's right for the working people. In the case of countries with right-wing governments, well, that's been sort of like a blessing in disguise, in the sense that it's a way to weaken their power in all those countries. But then that instability, it's the most common feature in Latin America right now. So as I was saying, against that, contrasting with that stability of the 1990s and the 2000s, we're going to see a process of instability as we're seeing in Colombia right now, as we're seeing in Peru also with an election coming with the neoliberal candidate Fujimori, but also Pedro Castillo, who's from a radical populist left. So I think it's going to be interesting, but also a bit scary, as we've seen in Chile, because when in this crisis, we see also how the state has a tendency to reply, to confront that instability with authoritarian repressive regimes, and of course, state-sponsored terrorism everywhere.
And how is the right reacting to this defeat? I'm sure they were surprised some, but they're not without resources. So what do you see? What are they saying, and what do you expect them to do in the coming months?
Some sectors of the right wing have been changing their approach to politics in this recent context of social and political instability in Chile, and a more organized demand for social rights and change in the political system. They have been turning towards a more centrist politics and also a more populist politics, in terms of even going beyond the neoliberal consensus of everything has to be privatized, deregulated, etc. So they call it the social right wing, because they are looking towards those kind of public policies that tend to be more associated with social democracy. But then there's another sector of the right wing that, after the election, has been claiming that this defeat comes precisely because this right wing has not embraced its traditional values. So they're calling to reinvent a right wing with no complexes, right? That they have to recognize that their more conservative base, it's what's going to take them to win another election, and not giving in to more centrist or populist policies.
Sometimes it's said that a neoliberalism was born in Chile. That perhaps an exaggeration, but there's some truth to it. And over the last few years, we've seen neoliberalism dying in Chile. How do you feel about that? Is that true?
It's interesting as a slogan. I don't think it's accurate, because neoliberalism is not a national phenomenon, right? So it's going to take more than a struggle against neoliberalism in one country. It's going to take, for instance, and this is probably one of the most promising, or at least the most interesting scenarios for the following decades, is how do we have an actual regional integration in Latin America, at least in South America, to try to overcome some of the limitations that neoliberalism imposes on countries. For instance, what happens with external debt, with the relationship with the IMF and the World Bank. Also, how do we share infrastructure in, for instance, in terms of healthcare systems and technologies that are going to help us to confront new pandemics? I think that regional cooperation and regional integration in a socialist perspective is the only solution against neoliberalism. I don't think, maybe it's pessimistic of mine, but I think that there's no way to overcome neoliberalism in one country, because neoliberalism is not a set of government policies. It's a sort of like a implicit and explicit consensus on how to work internationally in a global market. So that's my opinion on that. It's not so developed, but I think people are very enthusiastic about the prospect of a new government in Chile coming from the hand of the Communist Party and the Frente Amplio and some sectors of the left. Right now, there's a high probability that the Communist Party candidate, Daniel Jadue, who's a mayor in a municipality here in Santiago, is going to be the next presidential candidate, and he has very good odds. And they claim that they want to end neoliberalism. And I'm afraid that that kind of enthusiasm can be confronted with a huge desperation when they are definitely not able to end neoliberalism? I mean, how do you remove a country from the international market in terms of copper or forest products? Or
it's a small country that's quite export dependent, right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, we're completely dependent and exposed to all the ups and downs of the global economy.
Now, the Victorious Coalition, do they have a really clear roadmap of where they want to go, or are they just kind of invent it as they go along?
It's a mix, because you have two sectors that have won this election. One is that the coalition of Frente Amplio and Communist Party, but then you have the new social movements, as you said, organized in several groups, but that throughout the constitution are definitely going to create a political bloc that within the convention. And that's probably, we'll see the emergence of a new, I don't want to say a party, but at least a new organized political sector that it's definitely more to the left than the Communist Party and the Frente Amplio. So it's going to be sort of like a going and coming of that relationship, right? So if you have a left-leaning or progressive or popular government, you'll probably have a political sector on the left that it's going to be not exactly an opposition, but it's probably going to be critical support. It's going to defend its advances, but it's going to be aware of the limitations of that, as I was saying, of that social democratic perspective. So they do have a project of, as I was saying, enshrining social rights and healthcare, education, housing, and pensions as guaranteed in the constitution, but also in other public policies. They also have an economic policy of renationalizing natural resources in a way to actually control that dependence on the global market. And in terms of a political system, they are for a democratic, more open system, more participatory democracy. So I think they have a program. It's not that new, in my opinion, but it's definitely much better than what we've had so far.
That was the Chilean political analyst Pablo Abofom. He's got a piece about the Chilean elections on the Jacobin website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some more Idols, this model village from their album Ultra Mono, released last September. Till next week, bye. A lot of nine-finger boys in the village. They haven't got much choice in the village.